From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 22 years ago, 1992, when the Democrat and Chronicle chose James Lawrence to be the editorial page editor. And Lawrence admits he never expected to spend more than two decades in the position, maybe just a few years. But as it so often happens in Rochester, a temporary job became mostly permanent. Well, on Friday, James Lawrence retires from his position leading the editorial page. A lot has happened since 1992, and much has changed. It's also fair to wonder why so much hasn't changed. This hour, we'll talk about the future of the newspaper industry, the value of the editorial page, the stories you might not know, the career of James Lawrence. James is here to empty out all the skeletons in his closet. Welcome. This is your chance.
Thank you so much, Evan. Thank you so much.
I didn't say, you can empty out whatever skeletons you want in this hour, even though you're still employed for four more days there. Has it hit you yet?
It hasn't. To tell the absolute truth, it hasn't hit me yet. We had an editorial board meeting just this morning, and Karen Magnuson, who's the editor, came into the meeting, and we started to talk about transitory kinds of things. And it, as I sat there, and the conversation was going with others around me at the table, and it kind of hit me then that, okay, in a couple of days now, you're not going to be involved in this anymore after almost 23 years. So, yeah, it's starting to hit me. I just haven't had the time to really think it through since making the decision to retire. I've been so busy. We had the elections going on. Unite Rochester is going on. And so I've been really, really busy.
Are you part of your retirement is because we've now entered a post-racial period in the United States?
A post-racial period?
I kid. I know that you are.
I've
seen James on panels recently. It's amazing how many people to me want to say that we should be in a post-racial period. We have a partially black president. James, isn't this a post-racial America? It's hardly that, huh?
Hardly that at all. When you look at just what happened last week out of Ferguson, Missouri, and clearly we're not in a post-racial America. If anything, I've been thinking about this over the past few weeks, if not last couple of months, is how similar the way things are today to when I got into this profession as a journalist. Then a young African American coming out of Howard University in the early 70s, feeling empowered through education, through history, to go out into the world and really seek to change things. I felt good about that. This was a time right after the 1968 riots all over the country, Martin Luther King. And here's an opportunity to change all that. You know, as a reporter, my first job was at the Cleveland Call and Post, a black weekly newspaper in Cleveland, Ohio. I did apply, you know, all the major newspapers around the country, sent my resume in. Some of them responded, most of them didn't. But it was the Cleveland Call and Post that hired me. And I worked there for maybe about a year and a half. And I later moved on to United Press International. But the point I'm really getting to is that there was a lot of unrest at the time, just in our society in general, racially, as well as you had the war in Vietnam going on. But there was also a measure of consciousness that I especially felt and witnessed among young people wanting a better America, wanting a better life for themselves and for their families. And so we set out to change all that. Unfortunately, as I prepare to at least exit from this position, what I've seen is that Have things really, really changed? And disturbingly, they haven't in some ways. And although, yes, absolutely, there's been major, major progress. The fact that we do have an African-American president, we've had two African-American mayors in this community. So those kinds of changes have occurred. But at the same time, when I look at some of the reaction and the polarization that we saw last week after the grand jury verdict, it's akin to going back to 1968 and how America responded, specifically the African-American community, to Martin Luther King's assassination. So I'm somewhat disturbed by all of that. That here it is, 40 plus years later. I'm seeing that occur.
46 years since 1968.
Yeah.
Why then? Why is it that in 2014? There. Let me back up and say, I would guess that if I could go back and talk to you in the early 70s, mm-hmm. there's no way you would have believed.
No way.
That in 2014,
right.
we would see the
no
division.
Way. Right.
We would see neighborhoods essentially still segregated.
Right. Maybe even more so.
More segregated, even more segregated, especially
right.
in large urban populations.
Yeah. Well, New York State, by the way, has the most racially segregated schools in the country.
I just don't think that
New
you
York
would
State.
Have believed that 40 plus
no, I
years
wouldn't
ago.
Have.
So what happened?
I think we took our eyes off the prize. We took our eyes off the prize. And when I say we, in my generation, something one of my sons said to me, I think it was in high school, my son Jamil, and we were having a conversation about my generation and maybe some social ills and that sort of thing. And he was saying, well, I think your generation really has failed in many ways, and so we went on. We really went at it after you said that. And then I saw something in USA Today on yesterday, I believe it was, and it was talking about the advent of the new civil rights movement. And the lead paragraphs said the same thing that my son said must have been back in the 90s. That our generation, the same generation I just talked about, we were in power, we were going to change, had failed, and that we didn't carry it through. What our parents and their parents, well, I'm speaking of African Americans specifically, but the public in general, because if, after all, during that era, probably when you were like, you were too young to remember, Evan, but during that period, It was a period where young people were very energized about change in this country and about systemic change, and that was on black college campuses and predominantly black college campuses and white college campuses as well about changing. You know, many on white campuses were really more focused on the war in Vietnam
right.
and and on black campuses, it was more about equality. But somewhere along the line, we didn't follow through. I don't know, maybe we got into the system. And as it is, you get, you become parents, you have a mortgage, and somehow along, those concerns that you had when you were younger aren't a priority as much. So I guess the bottom line with that is that we need to find a way to get back to that. And I see pieces of it, the Occupy movement here a couple years ago. We saw some of it. We're seeing some of it now, post-Ferguson. But quite frankly, as we said in our editorial on yesterday, especially as it relates to the racial flare-ups, we go from flare-up to flare-up to flare-up, And yep. in between, there's nothing of consequences done. And that's why I'm so passionate about Unite Rochester and what we're trying to accomplish with that.
Well, and we're going to be talking much this hour about Unite Rochester, because as James is exiting the Democrat and Chronicle, his work with Unite Rochester doesn't necessarily diminish. So we're going to talk about that.
Sure.
Let me ask you, yesterday, for example, so much buzz about five St. Louis Rams football players coming out for the game, and they came out with their hands up, don't shoot pose. And today, the St. Louis Police Department, the Police Association of St. Louis, released a statement condemning those players, saying that it was anti-police, that they had issues with those. The players should not have done that. The NFL is not going to discipline those players. But there's just so much division on
this.
There
really is.
And let me ask you, on the actual incident in question, the death of Michael Brown, do those details matter to you? Does the grand jury testimony matter? Does it matter to you if Michael Brown reached into that car, grabbed Darren Wilson's gun, if he was the one who started that? Should we care about those details, or is this a larger question?
Well, it's both. And I don't know if you saw our editorial on yesterday, but we tried to talk about that, the facts versus the larger question. And the reality is, yes, the facts do matter. There's absolutely no question about that. And in fact, I've told a few friends over the weekend, I had a conversation with a young police officer, a white police officer, I guess it was on Saturday. And we were just talking about, he was a friend of Darryl Pearson's, who's also on the force, and we were talking, and his response, I asked him his response about what happened in Ferguson, and he was very matter of fact that, yes, you know, the facts speak for themselves. Self-defense, it was self-defense, and case closed, and that's what we tried to outline in the editorial. Well, it's not that simple, and not to say that it is simple, but there's more to it at the same time. When I say there is more to it, it is that for African Americans, seeing that they saw a young man, unarmed, 18 years old, who was shot at 12 times, hit 6 times, and given the history that we've seen in urban communities across the country, the relationship between police and people of color, flags go up, or automatically, flags go up. So to answer your question, it was, and to go to that demonstration, it was about Michael Brown, but it was about a lot more as well. It was about a system. And it's about how a system has been used to oppress it, a system that has been abused. And to just turn your head to that or turn away from it is very difficult for a person of color.
We saw Rochester's Mayor Lovely Warren make a statement on Facebook. It angered some of the family members of Darryl Pearson, the officer who was killed earlier this year.
Right.
And it angered a lot of people who, I would say, most of the response that I've seen, unfortunately, on this, James, has been
negative.
Left and right. Mm-hmm. Negative to the mayor, but largely white conservative.
Right.
And this has really been a polarized political issue. Did the mayor make a mistake?
I think what the mayor did, if you look at the statement, she clearly said that she was concerned about the decision. That is a representation of most people of color that I know of, you know, in my circles and even nationally. I was home in Florida last week, and of course, among people of color, this is the major topic of discussion. I think that what happened is there was the one line which police took offense to. The one line in her piece. And I thought that she was clear that she was not talking about the police situation here in her town, in Rochester, New York. I thought that was pretty clear. And I think that others thought otherwise. And to that end, as we said in yesterday's editorial, we need to have a discussion about this. And in fact, that's exactly what we're trying to do at Unite Rochester. And in fact, we're trying to arrange a meeting for this week of community leaders to have that discussion, to get beyond lobbing the verbal grenades and the insults. And there have been too many of them, the mean-spiritedness, the vitriol. We have to do something about that. And I think we need to have an opportunity to let the mayor explain what it is that she was communicating. And let's hear what the police department, you know, what their concerns are. I think that, you know, going back to the discussion I had with the young police officer this weekend, you know, I understood what he was saying. I clearly understood what he was saying about the matter of self-defense. You know, my oldest son, when he got out of the Navy, that's the first thing that he did when he came back to Rochester. He applied for a job on the Rochester Police Department before moving to California. So I can't say that I wouldn't have that concern if I had a loved one who was a police officer. But I think that we need to have a conversation to try to understand it. And it's sort of like with her statement, it's like the Dan Quayle potato saga, if you remember that. I think there was one line in the speech and everybody went ballistic over. So let's calm down, folk. Let's calm down and let's have a reasoned discussion about this. You know, it's a cliche, hurt people hurt people. And I think maybe some people are hurt, and that's understandable, given the sensitivity of what happened in our community.
We're going to get to the phones in a moment. My guest for the hour is James Lawrence, nearly a quarter century leading the editorial page of the Democrat and Chronicle and retiring at the end of this week. I look at my son, my toddler son. Mm. You know, kids don't have racial animus until they learn it or see it, I think, James. Mm. And it's not quite as cut and dried as that. I mean, to some degree, you know, there's a lot of different factors that go into it. But I look at kids, because I'm around toddlers a lot these days. When you've got a toddler, you tend to be around a lot of other kids. They don't, it's not that they don't see race. We do. We have to get past this goal of, I don't want to see race anymore. We see race. It's okay
right,
to see
right.
race.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't impact them. They don't have prejudice.
It's learned behavior.
And so I that's what I kind of want to get back to, is that if kids, no matter the age, no matter the era, are not born with that prejudice, we've got to get to a point where they're not learning it somewhere. They're not picking it up from somewhere. And part of it to me, and you can speak to this probably much better than I can, I look at the segregation. I look at kids who grow up in mostly all white schools or mostly all black schools. And then you don't have this socialization. You don't have this regular interaction. And it becomes something foreign, even though it's our own community. We've got to get away from that too, don't we?
Well, haven't we been talking about that for decades?
But you said
not centuries?
It's worse now, isn't it?
Well, in some ways it's worse. In some ways, now let's be clear. In some ways, things have, for some people, things have improved a great deal. But for the vast majority of poor people of color, it has not changed. People like myself, we've done okay in that my parents, who were, I didn't realize until I left home and found out that we were poor, but my dad went to fourth grade in school. My mother, ninth grade in school. These were hard-working people, and they wanted the best that they could provide, you know, for their children. And so I was the first in my family to go to college. So I've worked pretty hard, I've worked very hard. So with that work ethic, my life changed in many ways, but at the same time, I look around, even when I returned home, I was born and raised in Orlando, Florida. Many of my friends that I went to school with, and I was just home for a retirement party a week or so ago, and to see many of the friends that I grew up with, and some weren't there. They weren't there because they're in somebody's cemetery or in somebody's prison. So it's that some of us have been able to do better, to take advantage of all the great things that America promises, while others have not. And why is that? Why is that? I would think that many of our readers who write letters to the editor, who are pretty conservative, said, well, you know, you worked hard, and so you look at what happened. But at the same time, I can tell you, and without any doubt, that sometimes, while, yes, working hard pays off, but there are also times that even when you do work hard, that things may not pan out for you. And for those who are on the cuffs, typically their lives really do not go very far in terms of getting into the economic mainstream of America.
Let me get to the phones here. This is Carol in Rochester. Carol, you're on with James Lawrence. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jim. I want to congratulate you on your 22 years at the Democrat and Chronicle.
Thanks, Carol.
I'm quite frequently a writer, and I'm involved in the pro-life movement, Carol Crossett. You and I know each other and go way back, and I just want to thank you for being doing an awesome job at providing both sides a forum to express views, and to do it. You do it frequently, and I think it's a very, very hard thing to do because issues like race and abortion are volatile, mm-hmm. and you are able to do it with integrity and allow voices. Just wanted to say, I was yesterday at the gathering, the rally at the Liberty Pole, and I'm a little more partial to women leaders, but I have to say that it was a wonderful rally in the sense mm-hmm. that the leaders brought in a lot of art, whether it was poetry, whether it was music. At one point, we turned to the person who was standing next to us that we didn't know, and we pledged that we would respect that person. It was really done in a very, very beautiful and nonviolent way, and mm-hmm. my hope is that that will bring some longevity to it, because I think, you know, we don't want the passion to be extinguished. That is really what we don't want. But I think that this is really critical, and I thought it was just very, very well done. And by the way, I also went to Howard University. I am a native Cherokee, and I was allowed into Harvard into Howard on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, again, you know, the longevity is the key, and to keep it going in the long run, and in order for that to happen, we desperately need people like you who will allow both sides to be sincerely and peacefully vented.
Carol, thanks for the call. What do you think, James?
Thank you, Carol.
Some thoughts there?
Well, just on the whole issue of balance, I think balance is very, very, very important. It's important that all voices be heard. I'm in a place right now where I'm very concerned that on the media landscape in particular, it seems like everyone is migrating to a silo that's comfortable. And so we're not seeing balance. People don't care about balance. I think if you want to go to the conservative viewpoint, you go to Fox, the liberal viewpoint, you go to MSNBC. And so everything is being customized now. And rather than presenting both sides, you can take a clearer look at what each side has to say and kind of weigh it. It's kind of going back to the question you asked earlier. You know, I can see your point of view, the police officer's point of view, but the African-American point of view, I see that because I'm an African-American. So, but I'm not going to shut you down totally because I disagree. But I think that we need to have some sort of dialogue. And if we don't have that, then it creates this polarized society that we're living in right now. So that's something that we've tried to do on the editorial pages. I can definitely say in the 22 plus years that I've been there that you're going to see letters that oftentimes are very critical of the editorials and the editorial page, period. But that's a point of view. As long as it's cast in a civilized way, I don't have a problem.
But you probably see plenty of letters that are not very civil.
They don't get into the newspaper. And again, we said that on yesterday. We got lots of those letters just last week after the grand jury decision. So,
do they bother you?
Yeah, they bother me. Of course they bother me.
Do you keep them?
Yes, I think someone looked at me at the panel discussion that I think you attended a few weeks back, and they said, why? Because, yeah, I have a hate file.
You have a hate file?
I have a hate file, and I've had it for years. And when I get one of those letters, I just drop it into it. I don't go back and review it, but it's a reminder. It's a reminder of what's out there, and it's disturbing, and it helps me to recommit myself to fight even harder against this kind of injustice and hate that's out there, because you can easily become blinded by the fact that maybe I don't get those kinds of letters or run into those kinds of people. But the reality is they do exist.
How often do you get a letter that ends up in the hate file?
Well, I get a letter at least several times a month, and then almost daily I have this one writer. I wouldn't call this writer that his qualifies for the hate file, but he writes some very pointed comments. He writes all over the envelope and both inside and outside, and I just stack them up. We must have at least just over the past year maybe 75 letters from him. But actual hate, for the first time about 6 months or so, it was so hateful that I said I have to expose this person. I posted it. He didn't sign it, of course. He was a coward. Posted it on the editorial board blog. You know, it was all the racist kinds of things. Go back to Africa with your kind, and the N-word throughout it. So, you know, over the course of my career, I've seen a lot of that. I've seen a lot of it.
You ever been concerned for your safety?
Yes, I have. And my family. I have been.
James Lawrence is our guest for the hour. He is retiring on Friday after 22 years leading the editorial page at the Democrat and Chronicle. We're going to get to your calls when we come back. A lot of calls for James. We're going to talk about Unite Rochester. Okay. We're going to talk about the future of this newspaper and a lot of questions about what comes next, because there's been a lot of change to the Democrat and Chronicle. So short break, 60 seconds, and back with James Lawrence next on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, it's our Solar Power Roundtable. We're looking at solar power as a viable energy alternative. Is it viable yet? Is it scalable? How much does it cost to put solar power on your house, for example? And how are those costs changing? We have a panel from the business, the policy, all kinds of different backgrounds. Solar power, Tuesday on Connections.
Marijuana legalization has put high-quality made-in-the-USA pot on store shelves, which is tough competition for the Mexican supply.
It's grown in bulk outdoors. It's typically dried but not really cured, which is something we do here in the U.S. with connoisseur quality cannabis.
Hard times in Mexico's marijuana heartland later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your public radio station.
Welcome back to Connections. Let's go to Hoover. Actually, not there. Let's go to Gary in Greece. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, Mr. Lawrence, one, congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you, Gary.
I think you've done a wonderful job at the DNC. And you know, the interesting thing about the DNC is oftentimes I have friends on the left that say it's too conservative. I have friends on the right that say it's too liberal. And I constantly ask them, just read the paper, the analysis, your op-eds, the columns, for like 3 weeks and keep track. And I think you've done a really wonderful job of keeping it balanced.
Well, thank you.
In regard to the balance, I have a question about Ferguson. I was a police officer for 30 years.
Okay.
And frankly, when I look at the facts of the case, I don't know that I would have done anything different than the officer did. But I want to be clear. I agree with you on principle. There is a problem in this country. Mm-hmm. There's a problem with the number of blacks that are incarcerated, the number of blacks that are arrested, and the level of violence all across the board. But I think I agree. The response by the Ferguson police for the use of armored cars, assault rifles, and dogs at the first protest really exacerbated the problem.
Exactly.
To say insensitive at the least.
Right.
All of that said, this is what's been bothering me. It's somehow, and I have a great deal of respect for the mayor, but when she said her statement, there seemed to be an assumption that the officer approached Michael Brown, and I believe she used with a disregard for black life, and that, and I know you talked about the number of shots and this and that, but that has to do with training, and we can't get into it here, but that's the officer's training, and we may not agree with it, and I have questions about how officers are trained, but what bothers me, I'm wondering if you could comment on it, is the assumption that this officer had that mindset. I mean, there doesn't really seem to be any evidence for that. I hope it's not just that he was a white officer in the black community, because I know a lot of white officers in black communities that aren't racist or don't approach the community with a disregard for black life. And I hope that these protests address the issues of violence and inequity in our income, that all of those issues. But I would like to hear your comments on the part that perhaps, you know, the officer did what he was supposed to do, what he was trained to do, and that there's a lot of assumptions being made about him that don't seem to be quite fair. Thank you.
Gary, thanks for the call. Go ahead, James.
Well, Gary, I think you really, as I tried to point out earlier, you have to look at the historical perspective on all of this in terms of what has happened, even going back to, in recent years, fairly recent years, you know, the Rodney King situation. There have been, just this past summer, the Eric Garner situation down in New York City. I was sharing with someone recently. I was driving back from D.C. and driving through a small Pennsylvania mountain town, and I was stopped for driving 10 miles over the speed limit. And I prepared myself, you know, by this police officer stopping me, a black man driving along in a truck. I just bought myself a truck here not so long ago, which I love. And what was going to be his response when he walked up to me? It so happens that it was a female officer who was very cordial, and the way that she simply asked me for my license and went back to the car and came back, and again she was cordial. But it was all about the it was a respect thing. The tension that I was starting to feel, that just went away, and it was a courteous interaction. But all too often for many African Americans, you expect for police to treat you with disrespect. And that is based on the history that has occurred in our country. So we teach our sons, you know, when an officer pulls you over, keep your hands free, that he can see your hands at all times, because it's commonly believed among African Americans, especially if you're a black man, you know, that a police officer walks up on you, and if it's at night, that officer is going to be prepared, because he's probably thinking a certain way, and it's not in a favorable way, that maybe thinking that you're a drug dealer or whatever, you might have a weapon in the car. So there are a lot of assumptions out there, and that's not to say, and as we said in yesterday's editorial, I believe that most people of color have a great deal of respect for dedicated police officers, men and women, to go out there and do their jobs every day, watching the backs of citizens. But at the very same time, you know, it's hard to get away from, and we can't get away from it as long as we continue to do what we're doing right now, and that is sniping at one another and pointing fingers, rather than having a conversation, rather than trying to improve the relationship between people of color and police departments that are patrolling urban communities. So we need to work together to try to find a greater understanding.
Sam in Rochester, you're on with James Lawrence. Go ahead, Sam.
James, how you doing? This is Reverend King.
Reverend King, how are you?
Good. How you doing? And congratulations on your retirement, because I've been retired 24 years, and I always
that's
tell
great.
Retired. When the spirit of work come over you, just lay down until it pass.
I'll remember that. That's good. But, thank you.
But I want to just, doesn't the deafness of and the silence of the suburban churches, you don't
disturb
hear their
me.
Voices.
Right.
You can hear their voices on a lot of issues, but when it comes to, problems that are complex, their voices are silent, and right. The deafness is just—I don't know what it would be. It's almost like you're wearing earplugs when something like that happens, because they don't have any comments on that, and yet they're coming to the city, pick kids up and take them out to their church, but when a problem arises. I mean, there's nothing but deafness. There's nothing but silence. Mm-hmm. You can hear a pin drop on cotton. And, mm-hmm. and I was just wondering, you know, over the years, mm-hmm. you know, that you've been in the editorial business with the Democrat and Chronicle.
Right.
You know, have you seen any improvement in that? Because in order for whatever problem we're having in America, we all going to have to come together to settle the problem.
Absolutely.
Even when Martin Luther King was
Absolutely.
Doing, he was marching. There was we was marching together, black, white, Hispanics. We was marching together because we understood that there was a problem, and the problem was going to take all of us to come to the table, not just some of us. Now, and I just want to say this part, and then I'm gonna let you go, and then you can answer when I get off,
okay.
off the phone. You know, when the Republicans won the House and won the Congress there, now. Just think, they said that the president was not going to get anything done.
Mm-hmm.
Now he has been president for almost 8 years. The country is in better shape than it was when he got it. Our unemployment was at 10-something.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment now is at 5-something. He has done an excellent job running this country by himself. So whether Republicans got both houses or not, He's done an extraordinary job, but no one is willing to give him credit. And I've even found even some African-Americans that don't want to give him credit for doing an outstanding and excellent job as president of these United States. And people understand they're trying to get everything done before he gets out of office, and they're trying to pull him here and pull him there. And I must commend him for sticking to his guns and just getting things done. Mm-hmm. That really needs to be done, because he can't change the whole world and change their mind in just 8 years. And I tell you, one other thing, this country would have been in much better shape if the Republicans would have just worked with him a little bit.
All right, Reverend, I got to give James a chance to respond.
Let me jump in there, Reverend.
Thank you for the call, Reverend. That's right. He's got a lot to say. He's passionate. Go ahead, Jim.
Let's start with Obama. I don't know if you saw Friday's editorial page. We had an editorial that talked about the fact that this economy is one of the best since the so-called Reagan years. And he has not gotten the kind of credit that we believe that he should on this issue. Unemployment continues to go down. Wall Street is off the charts. People more and more are finding jobs every day. And if you recall, just maybe 3 years ago, those in Congress will keep saying, it's about jobs, it's about jobs, it's about jobs. Well, okay, well, that issue is being addressed. So there's been absolutely no acknowledgement of the fact that it has been addressed.
But if you want to give him credit for that, don't you have to talk about inequality being a bigger issue now than it's been in a generation?
Inequality,
wage gap, big, big problems in this country for a lot of people, right?
Right, right. So, yeah, I'm not about to say that the president does not have his warts and there are areas that he needs to improve in, but let's say... To credit him where credit is due. There are issues, and this is one of them, the economy, which is a major, major factor, and had been a major factor up until the last maybe year or so. So let's credit him on that. I'd like to address the Reverend's comments about suburban worship houses.
Yep.
And that is, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that it's way too quiet. It's too quiet not only when it comes to people of faith, as citizens, as a community, it's way too quiet. And it's akin to going back to my college years, back in the 70s, it was talked about the silent majority. I think the silent majority are decent people in this community, but they're not raising up. They're not speaking to these issues of race and inequality, whether it's economic or simply racial. I think they need to come to the table, because it's those who are throwing the darts. Those are the ones that we're hearing from. And this is one reason why Unite Rochester, to go to that, we're sponsoring a meeting this week.
Before we even get to that, tell us, we're going to get to that meeting. For people who don't know what Unite Rochester is, give us the broad outline, James.
Unite Rochester is a campaign undertaken by the Democrat and Chronicle about 2 years ago to really seriously tackle our economic and racial inequities in this community. It's a campaign that I feel very passionate about, because it's afforded the opportunity. Resources of the Democrat and Chronicle have been placed behind this campaign in a way that in the editorial board over the past 22 years or so, we've touched on various facets of race and economic inequality over the years. But under this campaign, the totality of the newspaper is behind it, both in our news coverage and on the editorial page. And that's a major, major contribution. And my hats are off to both Karen Magnuson, the editor, and to Michael Caine, the publisher of the newspaper, because it's not one of those sexy topics. It's not one of those topics that people want to hear about. But nonetheless, we have consistently talked about race in this community to the point that I believe that the Unite Rochester campaign is now seeing the kind of momentum that's necessary to take us to the next level to try to work toward the kind of systemic change that's necessary.
What's the meeting you were talking about?
The meeting is a meeting we've formed what we're calling a community crisis response team. We met 2 weeks ago. That team consists of some major players in our community, both elected officials and community activists. And the point of organizing that team was to deal with situations like a Ferguson, if it occurred in our community, or a situation like the Brenda Hardaway case a couple years back or a year or so ago, that we would have a team of credible individuals who could go to the community and assure the community, whether it's about the process that is underway or the investigation, or whether it's about a coroner's office report, that they could go and talk to the community about whatever is going on. Well, we had planned on reconvening this group of folk in January, but we've decided to reconvene them later this week to talk about what happened last week and what is it that they, as community leaders, can do to reduce the tensions that are out there.
Meeting details then? People want to check it out, James?
Well, it's not an open meeting. This is a meeting for the public officials and the community activists to talk among themselves about what it is that they can do. And then they can come out, hopefully with a joint statement, to say to the community, here's what we think. Here's what we think should be done. And keep in mind, it's going to be people. We're looking for representatives of the police department, elected officials, community activists, all sitting together. And in fact, the meeting will be mediated by the Center for Dispute Settlement to really come together and have a candid discussion about what's happening here.
So you get a sense for what Unite Rochester is and has been doing. And the question is, you know, what happens with a lot of things going forward? James retiring at the end of this week. Here's Jordan Weissman writing in Slate about American newspapers. And James doesn't want to hear it, but I'm going to read it anyway. At the American Enterprise Institute's Carpe Diem blog, Mark Perry finds that print ad revenues are now the lowest they've been since 1950, when the Newspaper Association of America began tracking industry data. Again, that's 1950, when the U.S. population was less than half its current size and the economy was one-seventh as big. Revenues are down more than 50% in just the past 5 years alone. We've seen a reshuffling. We've seen some jobs lost at the paper. What's going to happen with your job? What's going to happen with the editorial page, and what should happen?
Well, what's happening on the editorial page, we've created new positions. They're called community engagement editors, and those individuals will be in charge of opinion. There's going to be more solicitation of opinion from the public via social media, and of course, our standard bearer, which letters to the, always popular letters to the editor. We get some 15,000 already, and they've never gone down, the numbers of letters and essays that we have. So on the editorial pages, there will be changes. Now, I can't say, you know, what those changes are going to look like. I'm not so sure even the leadership of the newspaper has decided just what that's going to look like. But I can say that those numbers that you just pointed out are indicative of a need for newspapers to change and make a change. Right across the street from here is evidence of what happens when you don't change, when the platform around you.
He's talking about Kodak.
Kodak
hung on to film way too late. Is the newspaper industry, did they learn that lesson? Is there going to be a reconfigure? I just came back from Cleveland. They're going to 3 days a week with the plane dealer.
Really? I didn't know that.
There's some people upset that change is happening, but they're saying, look, we've got to reconfigure to survive.
Right.
Yeah? Are you comfortable with the changes? Is this just part of
it? It's really not, Evan. It's not about comfort levels. It's about survival in this new digital age and moving forward. Because if it were just about comfort, I think things would just remain the same. The Democratic Chronicle, despite what many say, we have one of the highest levels of saturation reaching our market of any newspaper in the country. For years, we've been number one, and we may still be number one when you combine the eyeballs that we have online and our readership numbers. So to disturb all of that is you could easily sit back and say, oh, okay, we're doing fine. No, but that's not what the newspaper is doing, or Gannett, which owns the Democratic Chronicle.
But James, I've got about 30 seconds.
Sure.
If you could go back and tell your young self, get into this career now, or if you were getting into this business in 2014, would you get into this business at all?
Would I? I think there's a real need. I think that it's necessary. It's a new business. We're doing things differently all the way around. I think if for people of color in particular, I think there needs to be a reassessment, because I think many are saying, no, I don't want to go into journalism. But I think those voices need to be at the table. I think journalism is still journalism. What's happening is the platforms by which we deliver the news to the public, that has changed.
Congratulations on your career.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you for spending the hour with us. If our listeners who are waiting on the line, we had a lot of interaction. We couldn't get to it all, and that's my apologies. But I couldn't even get to really half of what I wanted to talk about with James. So
this went fast.
Sometime come back and visit. I hope you will. I know you're going to be in Orlando, and you're going to be laughing at our winters. Will you come back and visit?
I will most definitely do that.
James Lawrence, the longtime editor of the editorial page of the Democrat and Chronicle, retiring at the end of this week. Thank you for your interaction. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to Mike Black and the team behind the board. This is member-supported public radio.